Tre. Can you hear? There you go. Bjørge and Jan Petter, can you hear me online? I see you in Blackboard, but I don't know if you're following, but if you... Finger. Okay, seems to work. Let me know if it's not working. Okay. Good morning and welcome to IMT 4116. Reverse engineering and malware analysis. Today we're covering chapter 4 in the practical malware analysis book, and the title is Crash Course in x86 Disassembly. If you've been doing assembly before, then this might be a repetition, but if not, then this is important for the analysis we're doing from now on. So I hope you found the presentation online. And I move the camera a little bit so I can point to the slides today. And we'll see how that works. And again, I have Collaborate open in Blackboard if you want, for those of you that are following the stream, if you want to post any questions, I'll try to pay attention to that too. All right, let's get started. So what have we done up until now? We have covered part one in the book called Basic Analysis, and we've done both static and dynamic basic analysis. We have looked at the malware from the outside, and we also have executed it and tried to see how it behave, at least in one instance, so how it behaves when we run it with the inputs that we can, the default inputs. So what is the next? We're moving over to part two in the book, which is titled Advanced Static Analysis. That means that this part is the code is still not running. Now we're going to enhance on the static analysis, and we're doing this by looking at disassembly. And disassembly, if you look at the dictionary, it means to take apart. For us, it means translate machine code into symbolic language, assembly code. So we can figure out how the program works. So now we're going to look into the code. We didn't do that in the basic static analysis. We just looked at the import export functions, strings, and so forth. Now we're going to really look into the details. And this is when the tool IDA Pro comes into to play, which is a powerful disassembler. It also has debugging capabilities, at least the paid version does. I'm not sure if your free version has the debugging capabilities, but that's not any crisis, because we're using, when we come to debugging in advanced dynamic analysis, we're going to use OliDebug, which is free. And if you later buy the license for IDA Pro, then you can, it should be no problem switching over. All right. So advanced static analysis. Let me just check my phone, see if there are students that are bugging me or... Nope. Ignore. Please stop me if you have questions along the way. So advanced static analysis. First, let's look at the life cycle. Malware we write in a high level language. I'm sure all of you have done some programming. When you use a compiler, you translate this high level language into a low level or machine code in what is called a object file. Then we have something called a linker that actually generates the executable, but what the linker does is that it takes into consideration the dependency such as we talked earlier about libraries, that some of them can be static. If we have static libraries, they're included by the linker at this stage. So this is done first, and then when we execute the program, the operating system loads the executable into memory, and that's when load time or runtime libraries are included. And then the loader would transfer control to the program by jumping to the first instruction. And this first instruction, this point, is called original entry point. Instead of just calling it the entry point, because malware often modify the original entry point so that the malware starts where it wants it us to start. So that's what we call the original entry point, where the code was supposed to start. I have tried to summarize this in a figure. Hopefully it shows the same as I just went through in text. Source code, through a compiler, you make object code, a linker that takes into consideration libraries, the static libraries, produces an executable file, or what we call a binary. Then when we execute, there's an OS loader that loads the load time libraries and loads this into memory. And this is a memory layout on the 32-bit system we're looking at. This will be a 4 GB area. We're going to look a little bit more in detail on how this area is built up later, but you will find the DLLs in here, either static, load time, or runtime. Static or load time DLLs. And then you will have a certain section here where the instructions are lined up one by one. And then when you transfer the control to the program, you point to the original entry point, and that's where the microprocessor starts executing the code. And if it needs runtime libraries, it will fetch them as it goes. In the book, they talk about level of abstractions. This is another way of seeing what I just said. You have the high-level language, maybe C, whatever you program, Hello World or whatever, or malicious code. You compile it down to something that the microprocessor or the CPU understands. What we need to do, you can always read this if you want, but that's very few people that are comfortable reading the hex code and the binary data at this level. So what we do is we disassemble, so we translate this back into a language that we can read. And that language is then the low-level language, or the assembly code that we're going to look closely on today. Book mentions 6 levels. Go briefly through them. Hardware, microcode or firmware, machine code, low-level language, which is what we're going to spend most of our time, high-level languages, and interpreted languages. So let's start at the bottom. The hardware level, that is the physical level where we find the electronic circuits, where all the functionality is implemented in digital logic, so XOR and or not or any other circuitry, which is difficult to manipulate by software. If these logics are implemented in pure hardware, then it's we can't really do much. But if you have programmable logic, there could be a possibility, but this is not our focus. On top of the hardware, we have microcode or firmware. That's code that only works for that exact circuitry. It interacts with the hardware, and we're going to, even though I know there are malware that goes down to this level, that's not the focus in this course. Then the next level is the machine code or the binary, which consists of instructions or opcodes And this is the level that actually tells the microprocessor what to do. And this is the level that was created when you compiled your, let's say, C code or whatever your program. Then this is the binaries that the microprocessor understands. Then it's the level of what we're going to spend our time. Low-level languages, which is a human-readable version of the bits and bytes that the microprocessor understands, consists of the different assembly or assembly language. Assembly, by the way, is the most common. There are other low-level languages, but assembly is the most common, so that's where we're going to stay. With instructions, opcodes like move, add, and so forth. We'll talk more about them later. And then a disassembler is what generates disassembly code from the binaries. And just note, the reason why we're spending time here is that this is when you have compiled your code into a binary and you've lost all the information around, this is the highest level that we can get back to in a reliable manner. I know that IDAPRO and other tools can try to get from this and back up to, let's say, C. But the further up you go, the more uncertainty there is if the code is correct or not. So we need to be comfortable at this level. And then, of course, on top of that level, we have the high-level languages, which is most commonly used. What we program in C, C++, and so forth. And that's the level that is converted into the machine code. And at the very top, we have interpreter languages like Java and other mentioned here. What's special about this code is that it's not compiled into machine code by a compiler, but it's translated into bytecode. And then it's translated into what the machine code on the fly when we run the program. That actually means that these are sometimes easier to read, or we have more opportunities to find back get back the original code that the malware writer used. Morning. When do we start? There's a question online. I just need to write. Hope you. Is the stream going? Okay. I hope that that question doesn't mean that you're not able to hear the stream, Bjørge. Let's keep going. So let's move to another term, reverse engineering. Again, from the dictionary, to disassemble and examine or analyze in detail product or device, and in our case, code, to discover how it works. And then it says here, in order to produce something similar. That's not what we're doing, but that is the dictionary definition. The key thing for us here is to pick it apart and understand what it's doing. So malware that we find is usually a binary, at least the one that we're going to focus on in this course. So when we disassemble, that means that we convert the binary into a language, assembly language, that we can read. And then it's our purpose is to understand how it works, not to produce something similar like the reverse engineering definition said, and also then to use the knowledge that we gain to defend against whatever this malware was designed to do. There is a chapter 5 that deals with IDAPRO, the tool of the most popular disassembler. I'm not lecturing that chapter. But we will try to provide some guidelines, and I will, of course, explain as I later, not today, but next time, go through examples. I will, of course, tell you how to use the tool if you're stuck. So so that chapter is there for you to read if you feel you need an even more information about how IDA Pro works. When we come to the assembly language, there are different versions depending on the type of microprocessor it's working for. You have x86, the 32-bit Intel, x64, 64-bit Intel, and then you have several others like Spark, PowerPC, MIPS, and ARM. Since Windows run on x86 and x64, we're going to focus here. Just notice that I'm sure you know that the 64-bit can also run the 32-bit. And I get some questions sometimes, why don't we focus on 64-bit malware, because that's new and fancy and aren't everybody using 64-bit now? But not really. We see malware on 64-bit platforms, but if you think about what makes sense for a malware writer, a lot of them want to hit as many people as possible. If they write a 64-bit code, they only hit the people that can run that. If they make a 32-bit malware, then they can maximize the number of targets because they reach out to all Windows platforms. So at least that makes sense for the malware writers that wants to hit as many people as possible, the non-targeted attacks. For the targeted attacks, the advanced persistent threats, the story might be completely different. Who's that? Just reading up with some questions online here. Björg, you don't see any stream yet. And he went to the wrong place. He needs coffee. See it now. That's good. Hey, I need coffee too. If I'm grumpy today, it's because the coffee machine was empty when I got to work. So I'm with you, Björge. All right. Let's look at the... So I choose, and also because the book covers, for the same reason, the x86 architecture, because that's most commonly used still, and it's also, if you learn this, the way over to other architectures and to 64-bit is not that that large. So in order to understand what's going on, let's look at the architecture. The principle that most or many computers are built today is called von Neumann architecture. This architecture, you have a central processing unit, CPU, that's job is to execute the code. You have RAM that stores data and code. And then you have an input-output device that is your interface to keyboard, monitor, hard drives, and so forth, whatever you need. So that's the core principle of most computers today. Exceptions do exist, of course, as in all topics in this course. Look a little bit more at the CPU. The CPU consists of three important parts, and when you're going to read assembly code, it helps to have an understanding of how this works. That's why we go through it. You have control that uses a register, a very important register that we'll come back to, instruction pointer. And it fetches the instruction from RAM. So when we load the program and it's located in RAM, the control unit fetches one instruction at the time and holds it or holds the instruction pointer that points to the next instruction, such that we can get the next instruction to then has to be executed. Then we have registers. inside the CPU, and that this is what the CPU uses frequently to store, temporarily store values as it works, much faster than RAM. For the CPU, the RAM is a slow place to store things, so it wants to avoid that as much as possible. And then you have the heart of the CPU, the arithmetic logic unit, which is the one that executes all instructions. So first takes it in from the control unit, executes it, and store the results either in registers or RAM. See if I can use this to see a little bit more how it works. This is from very small 8-bit processor. This is a simplified picture, but it still illustrates what's going on. Pipelining means that one instruction is fetched and executed, and at the same time as one instruction is executed, the next one is fetched. So you do, that's what pipelining means. And then each instruction, when I say an instruction is executed, in this case, that means that it's doing four microcodes in sequence. The first one is to decode the instruction to find out what am I supposed to do. Is this an add? Then yeah, some addition. Is it a move? Then I'm going to move some data. So you find out what am I supposed to do, and this is the CPU that does that, or the ALU is set up to do this. Then there's a read cycle where you read the data that you need, maybe what you need for the add operation. Then the ALU actually performs the action that is required, and then you get some results that you write back out to registers or RAM. At the same time as the first instruction is decoded, the program counter, the instruction pointer, is incremented by one. So instead of pointing at this instruction, you're now pointing to that one. And in the last, these are clock cycles, in the last clock cycle of the instruction here, you actually fetch the next instruction so it's ready to be decoded. And this way was the clock cycles. So for this particular processor, one instruction is executed in 4 clock cycles. That is probably different for the processor that we're talking about. This is a tiny one used in old smart cards. But just as a principle, this is might help the understanding. All right. No questions online? Good. Everything's crystal clear. Memory layout. So I talked about this. You compile the code. It's linked. It's the OS loader loads it into memory. For any program that we execute on a 32-bit machine, we get the 4 GB memory, virtual memory allocated. You don't necessarily get that in the RAM, but the OS makes sure you have 4 GB available, and then it decides whether it's stored on hard drive or in the RAM. The layout, simplified layout, looks like this. There are much more details in here that we could have shown, but let's start here. Sorry, I think I have slides for this. There you go. Start with a data. When the program is loaded, you have values that are put into memory. These may not be changed, and they're global. That means that they're available to any part of the program. So that's that one section. If you find executable code hidden down there, then that's should worry you. Then you have the one area that holds the actual code or the instruction that the CPU, when I say the CPU or the control unit, fetches one instruction at a time. That's what happens here. And the instruction pointer point to one address at the time here, and whatever instruction it points to, that's the next instruction to be executed. So that this is where we control what the CPU actually is doing. Then there's a dynamic area here, a heap that is for the program to use during execution if it needs to store values, and it the heap can then is built from, I'm going to say bottom up here, but if you I'll show that on a different slide. The lowest memory address is at the top here and the highest at the bottom, so this one grows from high to low. That's I'll show that on the next one because the stack is is the opposite, and the stack will is used for local variables and for functions and parameters for functions. It also helps the program flow. The stack is really important to understand the program flow of the malware, so we're going to look at this a bit more closely. And then it builds from low to high addresses. Please make a note. And I need to find this out in the break. I wonder if I have flipped those arrows around. some I got an inkling that is it correct? Okay. I just confused. Say it's correct, and I'll think about it in the break. And if I change my mind, I'll come back. But okay, let's say it's correct. It seemed, made sense when I made the slide, so I just it is confusing because there's some people like to draw the low address at the bottom and the high address on the top, and then the stack flips around, and then the stack is built the other way, and so this is, we need to really think when we look at the stack and the heap. So for now, the slide is correct. So. Until I say something wrong again. So those are the areas of the stack that are important to us, and especially the code section we will follow when we analyze code. But we also need to pay attention to the stack to see how it's used, especially when the program jumps in and out of functions. Let's see. No questions online. Good. Next topic, registers. Remember that was the small small area or the local memory place that the CPU has for its own use. So it's built in data storage in the CPU. Quick access. As I said, RAM is slow for the CPU. Since we're doing x86, so the Intel 32-bit, all these registers are 32-bit long, and they have different roles. We have general registers used for during execution. We have something called segment register, where you track sections of memory. We're not going to be touching this too much. This one we'll definitely look at. Status flags used to make decisions, definitely need to look at that. And the instruction pointer, very important, because that's the one that decides what the next instruction is. Table from the book where it's these registers are listed. General, EAX, EBX, CX, DX, and then you have BP, ESP, and ESI. I'll talk a little bit more about them in a bit, so if you don't understand what they're for, don't worry about it. Status registers is just one, and then you have the instruction pointer. Nice little overview. Already mentioned this, that they're 32-bit long. If you have a 64-bit machine, they're 64-bit long, of course. Four of the registers, so EAX, EBX, ECX, and EDX can also be broken down into smaller. I'm sorry, I'm jumping over there. All registers, all general registers can be referenced as the half register, so the 16-bit register. This is the before when we only had 16-bit computers. These registers were still in use, and now the E is for extended up to 32. So this can all be referenced, but the four registers that I mentioned can be broken even further to where you can actually address the lower two of the lower 8-bit sections shown in this figure, also from your book. This is the EAX register. You have 32 bits in binary or hex there. If you refer to AX, that means the 16 least significant bits here, and then it's this one that you can actually reference either the higher 8-bit of it or the lower 8-bit of it. That's what AH and AL mean. So the top 16 bits you cannot address in by themselves, but you can split up the bottom or the 16 least significant bits. When you go in and sometimes when you see code that rotates bits in the registers, it might be to get the bits you want to analyze into one of these smaller portions where you can actually address them. All right, the general registers, they typically store data or addresses to memory. There is nothing that stops the malware writers from using these registers the way they want them. So you can't look at how the registers are used and say, okay, this means that we have that result in that register. But there are conventions that a lot of people use. So we're going to assume that they follow the convention unless we see something weird. But just remember that it is possible to not follow the convention. And unless you're really good about writing code, it's smart too, because some of the registers might be changed by invoking certain instructions. So if you want to be sure, it's really smart to follow the convention. So I have a list here of the general registers for the x86. And this is the convention, and that doesn't mean that there are not other uses for this, but what's really nice to know is that the EAX holds the return value from function calls. We'll cover that later, or mention it again later. Base point for data, EBX. ECX is often used as a counter. EDX often as an input-output pointer. If you have strings, you might see ESI and EDI used. ESP, stack pointer, and base pointer, these two are used to keep track of the stack. And we'll see that when we do function calls that these are used. And then you have the instruction pointer. If I remember correctly, EIP, the instruction pointer, is the only one you can't directly manipulate. So you can't just put a value in there by random. You have to change it by using special instructions. Everything okay online? No questions? That is one 32-bit register that is used to control how the CPU operates and also used to indicate results. And this is just 32 individual bits that it's either set, then it's a 1, or it's cleared, a 0. And I mentioned 4 of them here. You might come across more, but then you'll just have to look them up. But 4 of them, most important, or at least important. The 0 flag, if the result of an operation is 0, can be used to create exceptions. Carry flag, if the result is too large or small for the destination. Signed flag, if you have a negative result. And trap flag is set for, if the trap flag is set, then you're in debugging mode and the CPU will only execute one instruction at a time. Could be nice for the malware writers to check that flag and see if we're debugging their malware, and so now we're into anti-analysis techniques. And then the instruction pointer, been talking about that a lot already, also called the program counter, but it holds the memory address of the next instruction to be executed, and this is the one that actually tells the processor what to do. Basically, if you can gain control over the instruction pointer, you can choose what to execute next. You tell the microprocessor where to go. Cannot be manipulated directly. And typical attack with malware is you insert code in the memory, and then the challenge is to how do we then change the instruction pointer to point to this code. We want the EIP to point to the memory location where we inserted the code that we made. So gaining control of that is really important for the malware writers. Questions so far? All right, we'll start on this. So 5 minutes before we take a break. Now we're going to talk about instructions, what actually tells the computer what to do. Quick recap, microprocessors, CPU, RAM, in-out, and buses, the von Neumann architecture. CPU, controlling the operation by fetching and decoding and executing instructions one by one. Program is just a set of instructions, and instructions consists of two parts, opcode and operand. The opcode specifies what the instruction, what we're about to do, and the operand what arguments we need the opcode to work on. And the CPU is very simple. It only has some basic operations, and by using those basic operations, it can do anything that you program. And those basic operations are transfer, move data on the buses between memory locations. Very simple. And then it can do, and this is the ALU in the CPU that does this, arithmetic, add, subtract, some logic and or, and some shift operations. And these operations are done between registers in the CPU and the memory location in RAM. And that's all the CPU can do. So whatever you program, it breaks down to these basic operations. And to specify these operations, we have the instructions. These are the building blocks of the assembly code. And an example here, move, I call it opcode, here is mnemonic, but it's a name, tells us what to do, move, and then ECX, name of a register, and hex value, and this means move into the register the value for the hex value 42. So this is the assembly language way of saying that. The machine code in hex and binary way of saying the same thing are listed here. So if you see B942000000, that means move the hex value 20 into register ECX. If you see this binary string here, it means the same. We're not covering that topic now, but how does the disassembler know where to start and stop in that bit pattern and interpret it exactly in that way? That's a whole new field of study, but maybe you can get a glimpse of the challenge for the disassembler here. And that's why we need to realize that the disassembler also makes mistakes and interprets some of the binary code in the wrong way. And even though it claims that it says move ECX 42, it might be wrong. We have different types of instructions. Like I said, data transfer, like move, exchange, arithmetic, log, and shift, some examples here, add, sub, and so forth. And then we have branching and conditional. And we'll go through examples of this in the second lecture today. Then a term that you need to be aware of, endianness. I hope I pronounce it correctly. If not, that's the word I mean. We have two different ways of describing bytes or bit patterns. Little endian, then you write the least significant byte first. This is what used in x86 or the Intel. So if the byte, the bytes look like this, C-A-F-E-B-A-B-E, well, then we write B-E first, first byte, B-A next, then FE, and then CA towards the end, just to confuse us. But that's little endian, and then big endian is most significant byte first, used in these processors. Important to know that network traffic uses big endian. So then it's just straightforward. This pattern written the same way. Example here with an IP address, which in hex translates into 7F000001. If you store it in RAM on an x86 computer, you start with the least significant byte because this is little endian, 01000007F. And if it's sent over the network, network traffic uses big endian, then it's straightforward 7F and then the zeros and the one. Yeah, I think I see it's 9 o'clock, so I think that's a good place to take a break, and we'll continue in 15 minutes. If you guys online have any questions, just drop them during the break, and I'll start with that after the break. Okay, see you 15:15. Okay. One. I'll give you one more minute before I start this. 09:14. So. Okay. First of all, I'm blaming I'm blaming the lack of coffee, but it looks like my gut feeling were right. If we go back to here, I've changed it now, and I'm hoping I did it right because it's dangerous to change things on the fly. But on page 78 in your book, it says the stack grows up towards zero. And that's what my gut feeling said, that the stack builds from a high to a lower address. So when you draw it with the high memory address to the bottom and the low memory up, then the stack grows up towards lower memory address. That should be correct now. And the heap grows the opposite way, from low to high address. But they're both located in the lower end of the memory segment. So, but please double check, triple check that I didn't mess this up, but I'm pretty confident about the stack. We're looking at page 78. I'm pretty sure also the heap grows the opposite way. So, but homework, double check that your lecturer did the right thing. All right, back to instructions, type of instructions, endianess. Two words about syntax. I will use, that's a strong claim. I will try to use, I should have written, because I will try to say that one instruction is opcode plus operand. And there is typical 0 to 2 operands. And in the Intel notation, you wrote the opcode, then destination and source, and that's what we will use. AT&T flips it around. They have source first, then destination. The move EAX 20 hex, move is the opcode, tells us what to do. EAX is the destination operand, so we want to move something into EAX. And 20 hex is the source operand, and that's what we move in here. Then we follow the Intel notation. And I'll try to use these words because I've written some words here. Operands are also called arguments, and opcode is also called operation and sometimes instruction. And yeah, the book calls the whole instruction, so the operand and the operation and the operands for opcode. So there's a we could probably start a fight there, but there are two parts. One part, opcode, that is the mnemonic, the word, tells the microprocessor what to do, and you have operands, arguments, afterwards that gives the input. Try to keep this these terms apart. Then we need to talk about how to specify the operands, and there are four ways to tell the microprocessor where to read or write data to. You've seen some of them already. You have immediate. That's when you just set the value, 20 hex. That's what it uses. Then you can specify a register with EAX. Then it uses the value in that register. Then you can specify a memory location, and memory location there is the RAM, then you can either specify or calculate an address, and we'll look more closely on that on the next few slides. The notation here, if you use these brackets, then it means use the value at memory location found in EAX. So not the value in EAX, but the memory location found in EAX. Might take some time to get to. Then we have something that is called implied, used in string certain opcodes might imply certain uses, and I'm not sure if we'll cover that or touch that today. We might see it when we analyze code later. A comment away from the slides. I talked to the ones present here a little bit in a break. This topic that I'm covering now, I know you guys are coming with a diverse background. So please give me feedback if this is too basic or too advanced, because I'm learning as we do this course as well. For some of you, this lecture especially might be too basic because you've done it before. For others, it might be all new and you need this. Please give me some hints on where you are. It might be that I, based on the feedback, need to change the requirements for taking this course and say that you need to know assembly. I skipped that entirely. Or it might be that this is the right level. But I need your feedback to decide that. Email is fine. Okay, back to operands. The immediate fixed value, you just write the hex value behind the register. So this means move the value 42 hex into the ECX register. Then you can specify use registers. So the operand is found in a register. So move ECX EAX means move the content of EAX into register ECX. Now please interrupt if this is not clear. Then we have memory addressing, and there are direct and indirect. Direct, we've seen this, means that you specify an address where you can fetch data. So you move EAX and then a memory address. Go to that memory address and use the value found there. Side note, when we start using OliDebug in IDAPRO, values like that or addresses like that in OliDebug will be written like this. In IDAPRO, they will use, let's say, D word if it is a double word, and the number behind there. You'll get used to that. Then we have when it starts getting complicated, and let me just mention this once, and then we'll if this is not clear, and then we'll bring it back up when we see examples. You can also calculate the address, and then it's called the effective address, and the address then has a format where you have a base plus an index times a scale, and you also can add displacement, and any of these can be zero. Move EAX and then the brackets EBX. Use the value found in the memory address that EBX contains. Then you can take move EAX and in brackets again EBP base pointer plus something. This is very common to use when you access the stack. The base pointer points to a place in the stack, and then you can move so and so many bytes up or down from that point. So that you will see that all the time. And then you have two that is more, can be more complicated to understand, but EBX plus ECX times 4 can be used by accessing arrays, where the 4 tells you how far in, and then you have another one where you can have a displacement and used for two-dimensional arrays. These two take some time getting used to. Now I'll move through some of the functions, some of the instructions. And please note that if or when you need to look up additional instructions, this is a link to a manual. Let's start with move. Move destination source moves or copies data from one location to another. And then use this is an example from the book. Again, very basic, moves copies EBX into EAX. Then it's the immediate value into EAX. Copies data from a memory location into EAX. Copies from the memory location found in EBX into EAX. And then it's copies whatever is from the memory location that this, when you calculate this, points to into EAX. So many different ways of doing this. Good so far? Load effective address. It's used to calculate with pointers or memory addresses. And it puts the memory address into the destination. So LIA EAX and then an expression behind there puts whatever was in EBX plus 8 into EAX. Notice, and this is important to this, there's a contrast to if you write move and the same expression, then it loads data found at that memory location into EAX. But with this one, it just calculates this and moves that into EAX. It treats this as an address and loads it into EAX. We can take advantage of this, and programmers do, and compilers do also. So you use this LIA function as an efficient calculation. So even though you're not dealing with addresses, you can still take an expression in there and pretend it's an address and put the results into a different register using the LIA function. So you will see this in code frequently. One more example, just to make sure to hit this home. Let's say that EBX is hex 2, EDX is hex 1000. If you write LIA EAX, so put the result into EAX and the result of EDX plus 2 times EBX. 2 times EBX is 4 plus 1000, so we get 1004. Into EAX, not the value at 1004, because that's what we get when we take move, but this time we get 1004 in. So move EAX and the same expression, we get the value at memory location 1004. And notice that move EAX and this expression without brackets is not valid. So you can't use the move instructions to calculate this and get the result in there. Then you need this one to do that. Again, this is an efficient calculation. You can say move ECX into EAX. And let's see, what did I write? That's right. If you use this function first to calculate this address, puts it into EAX, and then you can move it into EAX, then when you write it like this, then you treat ECX as a value, So you have Leah put this result of this into ECX, write it like this, and you get the result into EAX. If you use the brackets, then you treat this as an address, and you get the number located at this address into EAX. Made sense or confused? Did I confuse you guys? I just need to open up, there you go. And then there's a third example here from the book, just to really hit it home. You have these registers, and these are the memory locations with these values stored in memory. If you do move EAX brackets EBX plus 8, so what do we get? We're going to treat this as the value found at this address. So EBX plus 8, EBX is here. This value plus 8 will be 30048. 30048. So we're looking at this memory address, and we're using the value found at that memory address, which is 20. So this instruction will move the hex value 20 into EAX. If we use Leah EAX and the same expression, it will calculate this. EBX plus 8, get 48 at the end, and it will just put that result into EAX. So this time we will actually get B3004 8 into EAX. Okay. Crystal clear, I hope. You will mess this up when you start looking at code, as every other person does. So, but go back, use the slides, and keep this straight in your head. No operation does nothing. Why do we need that? It seems silly that we should need an instruction that actually is doing nothing. First of all, it's doing nothing. Normally it's implemented with exchange EAX, which is a function that, an instruction that moves the contents of one register to another and the other, so it just swaps the contents. This is used for as a NOP sled for buffer overflow attacks, and it allows you to put in code malware and create an area around the code that you can jump into with an imprecise jump, so you don't have to be precise about where you move your instruction pointer. As long as you hit one of the many no operations, they will keep executing down until you hit the first instruction that makes sense. So if you see tons of no operations in a row, then think buffer overflow and NOP sled. Arithmetic, just to cover more instructions. Addition and subtractions are some examples. Again, from the book, subtract. Use an immediate value, subtract hex 10 from, and put the result, take the value of EAX, subtract 10, and put the result back in EAX, is what it's doing. Add EAX, EBX, adds the value of EAX and the value of EBX, and puts the result into EAX. Increment and decrement, just plus 1, minus 1, put the results back in the register that you used. We have multiplication and division. This is when it can be a little bit more complicated. These are instructions that use registers by default. Multiply hex 50. we didn't specify any register, but it takes EAX and multiplies by hex 50 and stores the result in two registers, because the result can be a value greater than we can store in one register, so it needs two registers available. So here's a reason why it uses two registers by without us specifying it. If you do programming and depend on values in EAX and EDX, using that instruction will overwrite this and or use those value, or but also the result overwrites it. So that's what these conventions are meant for, to protect you from your data from being overwritten. But you can, of course, do it if you really know what's going on, and then you can confuse the analysts. Division, similar. Then it assumes that the result already is too large for one register, so it divides EDX, EAX. The notation here is that this is the most significant bits, and these are the least significant bits of the number, divides it by hex 75 and store the results back in EAX. And if there's something left over, then it's put that in EDX. Just to calm you down, if you're getting really nervous that it's going to be difficult to understand all the details in this, please relax, because in malware analysis, we're not looking at understanding every single detail. What you need to do is you need to recognize the big picture of what's going on in the code, and look for things that are out of the ordinary. Let's see. We have a question. If malware is checking the debug flag, is it enough to nope this instruction for further debugging? Now you're to answer that question. Yes, that's one way of doing it. But now you're into a topic that comes later with anti-reversing techniques, but a very powerful way of getting around, well, if malware writers write code that checks, am I being debugged, then one powerful way of getting around that is to go into the code and change the code and replace the instructions, let's say nops or something else, and make the code jump over that check. So very, very good. Yeah, you need to be patient. You're way ahead of us. So, all right. Final one on arithmetic, logic and shift. There are many more than what I listed here, but these are some of them. Just notice a couple of things: XOR, and then the same registers in both the destination and source. That's very common. It clears the register. Or EAX and a fixed value, logic operation between EAX and the value. And then you have shift and rotate. I'm not going to go through these, but there are many instructions that manipulate the bit values. Like I said, we look at the big picture first, and if we find something interesting that we need to understand, and we have to go down to this level, then we'll do that. But don't get lost in details. Okay. Stack and function calls. New topic. I'm sure you know this from programming. You can put things in a separate code that performs a specific task. Usually we do this if it's something that we're going to use several times. And then we call this from the main program. And then we need to temporarily transfer the execution to the function and a return when we're done. In assembly, this requires a prologue and an epilogue. And it's important for you to notice the prologue and the epilogue in assembly code, so you can see, hey, that's what we do before we jump to a function. This is what we do after we jump to a function. And then you recognize it and you don't have to use time analyzing it further. But there's a prologue that prepares the stack and the registers before we transfer control, and there's a cleanup process afterwards. A function might need input values and it's going to return a value. So we need to put these input values somewhere, and that's what we're talking about here. And again, there are different calling conventions. And these conventions specify how the stack and the register are used when we call these functions. Like I said, how are the arguments or the operands transferred, made available to the function? How is the stack cleaned up when we're done? What register should we not change? And how will we get the result back? And here are the calling conventions that we're going to cover. Cdecl, standard call, fast call, safe call, and this call. I tried to write in parentheses some of the where it's used. This is the one, here's what we're going to see the most, the standard call, but these two are so similar, I cover them at once. Arguments or operands to the function are put on the stack from right to left. And now I need... So if a function has some arguments put on the stack from right to left, that means this one goes on the stack first, that one second, and that one third. That's what I mean by arguments from right to left. Then it stores the pointer to the old stack. This is the register EBP. And that is because we want to restore this afterwards. It might be we might have function calls within function calls. And then we move the EBP once for every function call. So we can return later. The return values in EAX, or if they're too large, we use EDX as well. We see that EAX, ECX, and EDX are available, but we shouldn't touch these. And that's so the main program can know that the function doesn't mess up things that it needs later. Then it's the when we return from the function. That's when these two conventions differ. In the cdecl, it's the caller. So if you're in a program and you call a function, then it's the main program that you call from that are responsible for cleaning up the stack. So whatever you put on there and moved around, you need to remove that when you're done with the function call. In standard call, the function itself that is being called have to do the cleanup. And this is that. So what's happening up here is the prologue. So when you read assembly code, you need to see that before a call, function call, there's going to be put things on the stack. Then you, depending on the convention, you need to recognize that and see, okay, here, argument 1, 2, 3 went in, and see that. This is the epilogue. This is what happened afterwards. And you just need to recognize if it's... standard call, you see something at the end of the function that says, okay, this is cleanup. I don't have to bother about this. If it's a cdecl, it's outside the function, and you see, hey, this is cleanup. This is the epilogue. I can move on. Quickly through the other ones. Fast call, similar to standard call. but you use ECX and EDX first. So you take the two first arguments and you put them in ECX and EDX, not on the stack, and you do it from left to right. Then the rest of the arguments are put on the stack, and now they do it from right to left. So, and the called function is responsible for cleaning up the stack. This call used by C++ member functions. I'm not strong in C, so hope somebody recognizes what that is. If you come across this, arguments are put on the stack from right to left. This pointer, whatever that is, I'm not good at this, is put in ECX. And then call E, responsible for cleanup. I'm putting these in here for reference if you... if you come across it. I think the standard call is what we're going to see the most. Yeah, that was it. So let's take a closer look at the stack. So I said before, area in virtual memory, where we keep track of program flow, store local variables, holds argument for called functions, as we just saw. Last in, first out. Here I got it right. Grows towards lower address. And we have ESP, a stack pointer. So this is one of register, always points to the top of the stack. If you want to retrieve something further down in the stack, you use the addressing method that we said, ESP plus a certain number of bytes. EBP is a placeholder for functions. So when you call a function, you store the top of the ESP, where you are currently, you store that. You store this value, so you come back to this base, and then you move the ESP into this and create a new one for that function, and then you restore this afterwards. Here the arrows are correct too. A little bit more detail, we're not going to go through this in detail, but you see here stack grows towards lower addresses and heap towards larger, and the data and area that we found is split up in some other areas, not important at this time. There are instructions that let you manipulate the stack. We're going to go through four of them. Puts data on top of the stack. Put takes data away from the stack. And then we have call that transfers control to another function, and return returns to back from the function. There are two more ways of doing that, leave and enter, but I won't cover them here today. So let's look at push. You put the value on top of the stack, and then you update the stack pointer. That should then point to the top of the stack. Two examples, push EAX. Then it's the value of EAX put on top of the stack, or you can do the immediate value, push the hex 20 on top of the stack. Do one more example. By the way, this is a nice figure that I borrowed from Life of Binaries. And if you haven't discovered open security training yet, there are some great videos out there that might... that I could have shown here instead of standing here myself, but that would be cheating. But there are nice videos. I know some of you have looked at them. Life of Binaries is a good one. There's some for assembly and some for malware analysis and other topics if you want to check it out. All right. So this slide I borrowed from them. If you have these registers, you have a value in EAX, you have a stack pointer that points to that address, that should be this point, and then you take push EAX. What happens then? Then we take the value EAX and we put it on top of the stack. So we put it into the first empty slot, which is here, that one. And then we should update the ESP. And we see the new ESP should then be the next address. I'm sorry, the point to the top of the stack. So now it points to the top of the stack. And then we moved it down here to the address FF88. So now it points to the new top of the stack. And now I think just for they draw this lower addresses down. So they have drawn the highest address on top and the lowest address on the bottom. So their stack grows down. Other people prefer to have the stack grow up and flips this picture around. Then pop register puts the value on top of the stack into register and then updates the stack pointer. So this instruction will take the value on top of the stack into EAX. So let's say we, an example, if we move the hex value 20 into EAX, then we push EAX. That means that this value that is now in EAX goes on top of the stack. And then we pop EBX. Then we take the top of the stack, which is now 20, and puts that value into EBX. And for those of you that actually follow that, wasn't this just a move EBX EAX? Yes, it was. Or you could have taken move EBX hex 20 if you wanted. But just to illustrate the use of push and pop. And again, another slide from the life of binaries. We have EAX, that value, ESP pointing at this point, top of the stack. The top of the stack contains the value 3. Then we do pop EAX, take the top value and put into EAX. We see that there's a new value, the top value from the stack put into EAX. And then we update the stack pointer so it points to the new top of the stack, which is here. Address 12FF8C, 12FF8C. That's what happens when you write pop EAX. It says undefined here and then the value in parentheses. That's because it copies the value and we move ESP, so the value is still written in memory. I'm sure there's people that take advantage of that somehow. call, that's how we get into a function. So we transfer control to another function. Okay, the instruction pointer points to the next instruction that the CPA should do. What we do when we do the call is that we take the next instruction, I'm sorry, the address of the next instruction and push it onto the stack. That's so we know where to start from when we return. Because when we return from a function, we want to continue down the with the instruction that was in line there. So we take care of that. It's pushed onto the stack. And then the instruction pointer is set to the address of the that we specify here. We call a function. And that function is located somewhere in memory. So we need the instruction pointer to point to that memory location. And that's what happens after you do call and the next instruction is taken is saved. Then the instruction pointer is changed so it executes the function. So this is the call function is then the one of the few instructions that I can actually manipulate or change the EIP so we can jump out of the program, execute something else, and then come back. And you can specify the address by a name here or some value in EAX or an address there. There are different ways of doing this. When we analyze assembly code, the function calls are key points to look at. Because that's when you read the assembly code and you want to get a high-level picture of what's going on, you don't start reading at the top and at the bottom. You look for function calls and see what kind of functions does it call. And because that tells you, especially if these functions are Windows API functions, it can tell you a lot about what the code does. These are the functions that you saw in the import tables, the when we did static analysis. Now they're being used. We need to pay attention to that. All right, we're done with the function. We want to return. The instruction is called return. Very easy. Then it reads the address that we stored on the stack to find out where do I continue from now. And then it sets the instruction pointer to this address so we know where to continue. So this is another way of changing the EIP. What I have written here is that there's also a cleanup process, and you'll see it here. If you just write return, that's used in the CDECL convention because it just jumps back to this address, and then the following instructions should be there to clean up the stack. But if in standard call you might see return and then a byte value, and what this actually means is that you pop the EIP, so that's this, you retrieve the address of the EIP so you know where you continue to execute from, but you also move the stack pointer. That's what cleaning up the stack means. You move the stack pointer so you're back to the values that you needed. And you move them by n bytes that you specify there. We have 4 minutes and 5 slides left. It's going to be right on time, I hope. But there's a question. How often do you see self-modifying malware? Do they manipulate also the return pointer address? I think I'll need to get back to you with that question. It's a good question, but let me finish the lecture and then I'll get back to you with that. Okay, branching. We can't just have code that execute in sequence. We need to be able to have conditions that take us in different directions. So branching, code only execute if some conditions are met. We have jump instruction that can do this. That can be unconditional or conditional. Unconditional, you just change the instruction pointer to your new address. You just get to a point, jump somewhere else, forget where you came from. But then you can also have conditional, and this is assembly's way of implementing if statements. And then it uses flags to decide, so it checks different flags, and if conditions are met, you go one way, if not, you go a different way. There are tons of different types of these conditional jumps, all of the form J and then two letters. Some examples here, if one of those letters is the said, that means zero. So jump if zero, jump if not zero, specify with NZ, GE, so JGE, jump if greater than or equal, NE, not equal, and then the EIP is what's changed according to the result. And here's this is from your book. And again, this is not a complete list, but it makes sense. If you just study this a little bit, these little letters actually make sense. If you picture the equal, not equal, greater than equal, less than equal signs in math, most of you find here. And then, but in order to set these flags, we need to do a test first. And that's when these conditional instructions come in. These are instructions that perform a comparison. So if you see, very often you will see these test or compare, right before a conditional jump, right before there's a J and then two letters, because then you do a test and then you jump according to the result. Test compares two values. This is an AND function. But it's important to note, even though it's an AND function, it does not alter them. And sometimes it's used to test if a value is null. So if you do test EAX EAX, then it will set the zero flag if the result is zero. So that you can use for a conditional jump and say that jump if zero or jump if not zero. Then you have compare. Compare is identical to the subtract instruction, except that it does not alter any registers. Just do the comparison and then it updates the flag. And the zero flag here is set if the values are equal. So if you do compare EAX EBX, then you can have a conditional jump afterwards saying jump if zero, jump if not zero, or similar things. There, exactly 10 o'clock. And that was the last slide. I hope you survived this. Read the book. There's more in there. Use the open security training if you need to learn more. If this was boring, then let me know. Next week, we will... I'll do that slide because we have 2 hours of lab. That starts 10:15. But there is no lab to this chapter. So you're free to go home. No. Do whatever you want. But there is no specific lab to this chapter. But like I said, I will not cover chapter 5 in detail. I will go straight to chapter 6 and 7, which is we're going to recognize C constructs in assembly. And we're going to start looking at the assembly code to see what it looks like. So I would highly recommend that you try to familiarize yourself with IDAPRO. Look at chapter 5 a little bit. There's a lab after that chapter that might help you. Or repeat or continue working on the lab work that were given in the previous chapters if you're not done with it, because we're not slowing down the speed here. We're picking up. So... Question from online. Will you be using the commercial or the free version of IDA? We will be using the free version. That's all I can give you. I'm not that rich that I can buy you a license of IDA. So for this year at least, NTNU does not have licenses for IDA Pro that we can hand out. So we will make do with the free version. There are limitations, but I don't think those limitations are relevant for this course. But if you're going to work with this, I would highly recommend to buy the license version if you find IDA Pro useful. Any more questions online before I close this lecture? Any from the classroom? No. Then thank you for today. You reach me at mail. Use the chat in Blackboard to share experience between yourself. And I'll be available from 10:15 until noon in Blackboard or in the classroom for questions regarding the labs up until now or this lecture or whatever. All right. See you in 10 minutes. Or we can say 15 since I stole 5 minutes. Say 10:20. We're back at 10:20. Bye.